Judgment Eve. John C. Wright. 1. Imagine the boulevards of Golgolundra on the world's last day, and the angels circling like vultures above it. Everywhere is noise and lights and gaiety and crime and chaos. Imagine every wall and window of the crowded towers colorful with graffiti. The graffiti of these times are bright, not sloppy, composed of computer-assisted images of artistic depth and merit. They move, they sing, they speak to passers-by, and some of them reach from their billboards and kill whomever seems dispirited, obnoxious, dull. Tiny flicks of paint flying up, reforming in midair into blades or poisoned plumes of gas. Other people, beautiful or monstrous or both, dancing in the street in their fantastic costumes, applaud and cheer when some vivid nearby death splatters them with blood. They do not wish to seem dull. The whole city screams and screams with laughter. Why this forced gaiety? Why this hideous display? Today is the birthday party for Typhon, their founder. Today is the wake for mankind. Tomorrow, the angels drown the world. The streets are a festive combination of war zone and Mardi Gras. Imagine most of the crimes are committed by the young, who are most extravagant. A shy young boy sees a laughing woman sway by, surrounded by handsome admirers raising glasses of champagne and poison. It takes him but a moment to program his assemblers. A diamond drop, unnoticed, stings her flesh or flies into her wine. A moment later, it has taken carbon from her blood to construct a series of gates, and it erupts along major nerve channels in her spine. The programming is precise and elegant. There is no jerkiness as her arms and leg muscles move, stimulated without her control. She tries to cry out for her companions. Instead, her lips move. She hears her voice make clever excuses, and away she walks with a shy boy. He becomes a shy rapist, perhaps using his controllers to overload the pleasure centers of her brain, or pain centers, before doing whatever else to her his bored imagination might conceive. Or imagine a laughing woman, irked by an unwanted stare, or prompted by real fear, who programs her assemblers to shoot into the boy's flesh, so that in mid-festival, surrounded by unsure giggles, he will fall, his arms and legs distorted into clumsy, lopsided shapes or boneless tubes of flesh, while he stares in horror at the grotesque growths sprouting up from what was once his groin. And perhaps she does not know who has offended her. Without sumptuary laws, faces and bodies change from day to day like images in nightmare. Better, she thinks, to program all assemblers to reproduce and strike at random. Any flesh they enter, check for genes. Spare those who carry XX chromosomes. Now imagine not two such folk, but a city of such people. Creatures of godlike power and infantile rage. The sky above Golgolundra is dark with brilliant diamond points, thicker than confetti, a blizzard. And by now no one can tell who sent them out, or when, or why, or what their original programs were. And where the assemblers fight each other, which they do often, the reaction heat from their rapid molecular manipulations starts fires in the city. No one fights the fires. More people would be dead more horribly were it not for the invigilators. They soar in the high, pure air far above, surrounded by rainbows and rings of force. Their technology is very different from that of the Earth. When they dive, one can see man-like shapes, faces and forms of ruthless beauty. Their personal shields clothe each one in a radiant nimbus of gold, and the forces which give lift to their flying cloaks make their wings to shine. Where the nimbuses sphere their heads, the glancing light makes golden rainbows appear and disappear. Their faces are inhumanly perfect and stern. The mental training systems brought by the ship of the will give each one a perfect calm and utter sanity, the calm of a frozen winter pond. Is it any wonder men call them angels? From their eyes dart slender rays, like a warship's searchlight, sweeping back and forth, penetrating crowds and clouds and hidden places. Where they glance upon weapons or explosives or fighting machines, they squint, and the rays of light tremble with mysterious force and consume what they see with fire. Sometimes the weapons, before they are found, discharge a futile shot or two toward the angels, whose shields flare to higher energies, flashing like whirlwinds of fire. People applaud when this happens. Imagine Golgolundra. Everyone laughs. No one is happy. Everyone is doomed. 2. There is one young man among the dancing crowds who does not dance. He dresses in black and does not laugh. He is not doomed. And perhaps he has a chance, if small, to become happy. In his forehead glints a ruby gem. Any passerby with a proper machine can read his thoughts. The grim look on his face saves them the effort. His thoughts are clear. The crowds part when he walks by. The dancers fall silent. The graffiti images recoil and do not molest him. He is Idomenes, son of Deucalion. His genetic modifications are not the same as those who live in Golgolundra. He is a Promethean. They are Typhonides. He comes to the central tower, which serves Golgolundra as administration, rebellion center, entertainment capital, and whorehouse. Idomenes paces down the wide corridors, looking neither right nor left. The monstrous statues, grotesque murals, or weeping deformities in their glass cages do not attract his attention. From his black cloak, black diamonds fan out, sweeping the corridors before and behind him like nervous soldiers or presidential bodyguards, edging around corners, darting near anything suspicious, maintaining their spacing and their overlapping fields of fire. He ignores all this motion. He walks. When he comes before a certain door, perhaps he is impatient with precautions. The swarm of black diamonds flutter back beneath his cloak, or come to rest in jewelried patterns along the chest and sleeves of his dark doublet. The door recognizes him, and without a word, politely opens. Lounging at ease on a daybed on the balcony, dreamily watching the distant fires, a woman of haunting beauty reclines. Her skin is the color of coffee with cream. Her hair is as black as the midnight sea. She wears it very long. When she stands, it falls fragrantly past her rounded hips and brushes her shapely calves. When she lies on her stomach, it is long enough that, even when braided, it can be used to tie her wrists and ankles. When she lies on her side, as she does now, it forms luxurious cloudscapes and falls little waterfalls from bed to floor, stray, locks swaying. Above the couch floats a mirror. She watches the little glints of her white assemblers caressing her body. Where they pass, a garment of black lace is being woven tightly around her curves. The garment has no seams and would have to be unwoven to remove it, or roughly ripped off. She pretends she does not see she is being watched. Now she stretches and yawns like a cat, arching her back and moaning. She turns on her stomach and regards Idomenes with mock surprise. Her eyes are half-lidded. Her frail lace garb is half-woven. He does not remove his gloves, but at least he holds his hands at his sides and makes no gestures.
Idomenes speaks first,
grand with simplicity. Lilimariah, I want you to come with me to the stars. Lilimariah smiles mysteriously, as if charmed by distant music. Her voice is husky and low. Men want only what they can't get, That is the nature of desire. She stirs and half arises, so she is leaning on one arm. Her hair is electrostatically charged, so that it floats and sways as if in a breeze, even though there is no breeze. A lot of people would like to go to the stars, sweet lover. The angels won't let them. All but your folk. The sheep. I broke an oath to tell you these things. Do not mock my people. They will be saved.
Idomeneus speaks harshly, stepping forward.
Now he is close enough to smell her perfume, and his expression weakens into confusion and anger. His eyes burn like the black diamonds glittering in his coat. She makes a swaying, supple motion of her naked shoulders, perhaps intended as a shrug. What do you have that the angels want to save? Some pretty angel lass fall in love with you? The muscles twitch in the corners of his jaw. You mock them, too? When the ship first came from the stars, she saved us from the devastation of the wars. We begged her to govern and guide us. The ship showed us how we might remove all the vicious old structures from our brains and genes, madness and rage and panic and hate. The ship made the invigilators to show us how it was done. Were we grateful? Did we learn? Did we listen? Invigilators. How quaint. You're so old-fashioned sometimes, lover. We call them angels of death. Do you think they want to kill? How many chances did we get? How many wars did we start after how many warnings? How many people of the sea did we obliterate? Dolphins. We call them dolphins. And there were complex reasons for the genocide war. Economic reasons and stuff. Turmoil. And why did the ship make them members of the Galactic Will when humans were kept in protectorate status? Them, we made them. And now we were second-class citizens. Complex reasons? Rage and jealousy and race pride? Explain the complex reasons for the extermination camps and torture circuses. They were cutting into our trade with the ship. Maybe they were richer because they didn't kill each other all the time, as your people did mine. Was there a complex reason for that, too? Or was it just an expression of the rage and aggression your people will not remove from your brainstem structures? Some people think evil has survival value. It is the purpose of the law to see that it will not. He speaks in a voice of dark majesty. Don't let's argue politics again, she pouts. That's all ancient history. 50 years ago is hardly ancient. We never did anything to deserve this. No children. The ship sent a barrenness to all our women, yes, and sent plagues to sterilize the men, but that was for mercy's sake. There were to be no children when the world drowned. And now the Typhon's coffin is found and thawed, and he grows the last few weeks to become a man, it is done. There are no children left, no innocent lives. Today is Doomsday Eve. The hour is come. And why are you here, lover? She pouts and tosses back her head. I hate long goodbyes. They bore me. I've come to save you. My love for you burns like a devastating fire. It conquers my will and heart and sense and soul. You are the fairest child of a condemned and evil race, but I cannot believe, and I will not, that such beauty hides a soul wicked past cure. His eyes are narrow slits of fire. Now he steps forward and seizes her fragrant shoulders with his hands. Some of his assemblers, misunderstanding the sudden gesture, fly up to either side and hover like wasps, a sight of terror. But either her nerves are steel, a common replacement, or she is drowned in hysteria. She throws back her lovely head and laughs. He shouts, "Stop laughing! You want life. You must want my love. Such love as mine cannot go unanswered. It dare not." Then more quietly he says, "I will defy the invigilators. They will be convinced by the force and ardor of my soul. If you were my wife, do you see what I am offering? If you were a member of my household, the angels would not let me leave you behind. She gives him a cool, remote stare, her perfect lips hovering on the hint of a smile. He steps back, deflated. As he draws his hands down, the deadly assemblers drop close to the floor and draw back.
Idomeneus says,
"Why this coldness? Tell me what you want." She is on her hands and knees, her fingers knotted into the silken fabrics of the bedclothes. Lily Mariah keeps the same small half-smile on her lips, but she trembles when she speaks. "I want to be forced. Kidnap me. Kill my father. Burn this house. Take me by force. Take me." What a horrible thing to say. Are the angels right about us? She laughs. That way I can't be blamed. Don't you understand women at all? Sane women I do.
Idomeneus looks at her oddly.
Are you drunk? Have you been intoxicated against your will? There may be neuro operators interfering with your brain chemistry. He raises a finger and points at her. A black diamond flickers up from the floor, ready. She screams, writhing backward. She is on her feet near the railing, perhaps ready to fall or jump. He raises his hand, spreads his fingers. The black diamond falls back. "Don't you dare interfere with my body," she shouts. "What is it?" Silently, softly, she says, "I'm pregnant." He says, dumbstruck, "No woman can be pregnant. We can make children artificially. The assembler technology was made for that. But no one but the angels knows what codes they use to force our biochemistry into sterile patterns." She says sharply, "Has it never occurred to the great Idomeneus that there are assembler programmers better than even him?" He snorts. "No, that thought I do not admit." Now she steps forward, hips swaying, her eyes glinting with danger and pain. "And has it never occurred to you that I might have another lover? One who can give me the child you cannot?" Idomeneus steps back, as if he'd been slapped. "I thought you loved me." "Why?" "You said..." "I say a lot of things," she tosses her head. "I thought it was that my father speaks with the angels, that my people were special, that you were attracted to my... "Your purity? Your righteousness? It is your worst fault. You wanted my knowledge of assemblies, then. Is that it? You thought I could crack the angel's code?" Lily Mariah folds her hands on her belly. Her head is bowed forward slightly, so that her hair falls about her like smoke. "There are needs a woman has no man can understand, and duties." He turns and leaves at this point, his face drained and hollow, his expression something more horrid than anger. The door opens, not swiftly enough to suit him. He points, flicks his fingers, makes a fist. Black assemblers rearrange the wood into nitroglycerin compounds and blow the door panels out of their frame. The shrapnel and smoke that strike him leave blood mingled with burns on his face, but his footsteps do not slow. He does not hear the end of her sentence. "Duties even stronger than love." Her hair hides her tears. His assemblers re-knit his torn flesh and clean his skin before he goes down two corridors. He comes into an atrium. Here is what looked like a boy of 8 or 9 years, dressed as a harlequin, surrounded by a large flotilla of diamond assemblers.
Idomeneus is in no mood to speak.
He brings his hands together and makes a gesture. The harlequin's assemblers tremble and drop to the floor, dead, before any signal can move. "Wait!" shouts the boy. "I'm not a synthetic. I'm real. Killing me would be murder."
Idomeneus is pointing his finger,
and his black assemblers, like a little galaxy, crowns upon crowns around him, hang in the air, ready. All the real little boys are grown up. I'm 21 today. I just made myself look this way because everybody hated me as I grew older.
Idomenes lowers his hand.
The black assemblers spread out and drop lower, idling on standby. You're Typhon. I am also her father. You? Impossible! I made her when I was 12. She grew up as I slept. You've studied assembler technology history. The major advances in carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen manipulators are credited to you, all between 16 and 20. A child prodigy. My first experiment was to stimulate my own neurochemistry to greatest speed and intelligence. There was a danger of madness, it's true, but what's a little insanity between friends? I knew I had to live my life only in my youth, because my life was going to be the shortest one of all. Imagine being the one child the execution of the whole planet was waiting for. Imagine being responsible for that.
Idomeni's voice shivers with pity.
It's really not your fault. Typhon snarls. What do you know of it, gentle boy? What do you know of guilt and hate? They cleaned your genes of all those bad thoughts, didn't they? That's why you get to live, huh? But this is the city of the Typhonides. All the folk of Gogolundra are based on patterns of mine. Battle lust and killer instinct at its best. We'll see whose survival strategy is better, wild or domestic.
Idomenes raises his hand and spreads his fingers.
Black diamonds swirl upward, forming little clusters in the air around him. I don't wish to fight you. I believe fighting is evil. But you want to murder the one who stole my daughter from you, don't you, gentle boy? Don't tempt me. I know who it is. The matter does not concern... Didn't you think she was acting strange? I know you stung her with an analyzer, quick from behind, while she was jumping off the bed. Sneaky and curious, aren't we? Maybe there's hope for you yet, huh? Look at the blood readout.
Idomenes now closes a fist and holds out a pinky.
One slim black diamond touches his glove's fingernail, hovering. A unit in his thumb projects images into his eyes. She is under a love potion. Drunk. It's affecting her estrogen levels and parasympathetic nervous system. And...
Idomenes lowered his hand.
The assembler, forgotten, tinkles to the marble floor. She really is pregnant. Then he straightens. But someone used a mind-altering technique on her. The little boy steps forward. Let me see.
Idomenes points his thumb at Typhon.
To their eyes, the atrium is gone. They float in a world of gigantic molecular chains, complex diagrams, brain patterns, nerve energy comparisons, biochemical formulae.
Idomenes says,
the glamour is using a combination of neurotransmitters to trigger a sexual response, affect pulse and respiration, with this chain here used to receive a coordinating signal. Note the decentralized structure of the hypnagogic state inducers in the hypothalamus, Typhon comments. Clever work. They nod at each other, in mutual admiration of craftsmanship.
Idomenes highlights one of the image strands.
Here we have the same information architecture governing the internal nerve-body reactions in the cerebrum and upper brainstem. The destruction of any part of the love potion is insufficient. It holographically restores itself. Unless you know the key control sequences. Unless you know who sent it.
You know. You keep her watched.
Who? I will tell you, for a price.
On the world's last day? You'll tell me, or...
Or what?
I'll live to regret it?
Don't threaten me, gentle boy. You've had your killer instincts removed. Idomenes banishes the vision so that Typhon can see the menacing circle of black assemblers that had formed a circle around him.
Idomenes says,
"A man can do by deliberation what his instincts don't allow. Talk."
"Ooh, ha! But your precious purity of soul goes sour if you play rough. One slap and the angels let you drown with the rest of us. And you can't hide the crime while you wear that ruby in your head. Domesticated animals have no secrets, remember?"
"But then I can't make a deal, either."
"But what I want, the angels won't care. Information."
"Speak," the little boy says softly.
"Your father has a complete genetic library of all the human and hominid races of the earth. The angels helped him to collect it. They gave him a program for his wife Pyra, so that her children may carry all racial characteristics in their inference, to emerge in later generations and alter them. One woman with the ability to restore the entire race to full genetic diversity. I want a copy of that program."
Idomenes taps a finger on his palm. One larger black diamond swims forward out of the swarm and hangs in the air before Typhon's eyes.
"Here it is." "The whole library and one crystal? You're lying."
"I'm wearing a truth ruby. You can check. You can also check to see that I'll give it to you a moment after I have the name."
"It is a deal. Turn my gloves back on so that the city mind can record our handshake."
"I thought Golgolundra was mad."
"Faked. I wanted the angels not to interfere with our internal computer sequences."
A set of screams from outside interrupt. There comes the clamor of explosions, the roaring thunder of angel flame cutting through walls. Because Typhon's gloves are working, one of his radio diamonds carries the noise of Lily Mariah's shriek. Perhaps it is a sound of delight, perhaps a cry of pain. Idomenes is already running down the corridors back. Typhon's little legs cannot keep up.
"The library! Give me the library!"
pants the boy, the ruffles of his clown suit bouncing and flopping with each step. Idomenes does not turn his head, but runs in swift, lunging steps.
"The name!"
he shouts back. Typhon falters and stops. As Idomenes turns a last corner, he hears the little boy's weak voice behind him, trembling with malice.
"Fool! Fool! Who else can it be? Who else knows the angels' fertility codes?"
Idomenes turns the corner just in time to see, framed in the still-smoking rectangle of the doorframe, a man of unearthly handsomeness, Lily Mariah thrown across his shoulder, standing balanced on the balcony rail. A golden light is all around him. His surcoat is black, a color the angels do not normally use. His wings unfold swan-like from his shoulders, shivering with crackles and darts of energy. His eyes are filled with light. He is looking upwards. Lily Mariah's perfect bottom is high in the air. Her shapely legs are kicking. But Idomenes sees her smile falter when she glimpses Idomenes over her shoulder. The angel flees upward, supersonically swift, a swirl of dust leaping after him. The room is empty. A moment later, a crack of supersonic noise rolls like thunder far overhead. Idomenes stands, staring at nothing, while wave after wave of grief and astonishment at how tremendously he has been betrayed sweep through him. Typhon, panting, walks up behind him.
"Azaziel. His name is Azaziel. He's the one who found my cryogenic coffin and brought me back here to my home. Just in time for my long-delayed birthday party, eh? No regrets, though. Gave you guys an extra 30-some-odd years to prepare while I slept. Kind of like condemned women getting pregnant to delay a hanging, isn't it? One sleeping baby saving the world. Can't believe how foolishly my people here wasted this technology. It's all so obvious. The angels wouldn't even be able to threaten us if we had kept our heads about this. But hey, give people a way to commit crimes without anyone finding out, I guess they'll do them, right? All sorts of gross crimes.
I wish I was sure the angels weren't right about us after all, but what the heck? You gotta root for the home team if it's your team, right? Anyway, that was Azaziel, Uriel's lieutenant. I don't know what Lily did for him. Maybe she told him the ship's real reason for the doomsday drownings.
Idomenes makes a gesture, a flick of a finger, no more.
A large black diamond hops toward Typhon.
Idomenes speaks like a man in a dream.
Here. The library. Thanks. Where are you going?
I know where he must be headed. There is only one place on Earth which will be preserved from drowning.
Grief and fear are in Idomenes' voice,
uncertainty in his eye. He touches the gem in his head with a nervous finger. The little boy whispers,
"You're afraid they'll see, genes or no genes, that you still know what hate is. But they won't blame you for thinking about attacking a bad angel, will they? And my daughter, don't you have to rescue her? You're the only one who knows where Azaziel is going. You said so. Aren't you a hero?"
The last comment is uttered with a sneer. A sneer that deepens after Idomenes departs. 3. Toward twilight, Idomenes sees from afar Azaziel on the eastern side of Mount Natushim, where the palaces and museums of his father are. Here is the place where Deucalion had brought all the works of man, gathered over years to be preserved, and made gardens and houses for the sustenance and delight of the expected hordes of mankind deemed worthy enough to be spared.
Idomenes wonders why the streets are empty.
Not quite empty. There are two figures here. The dark angel is standing on the lip of a fountain in the high square between the observatory and a many-pillared archive. The third side is railing, overlooking far slopes below. To the fourth side, behind and above the fountain, the ground rises again, buttress upon buttress of white marble and crystal windows flaming ever upward to a fantastic mountain. Palace atop palace climb up the manifold gentle crags looming here, delicate spires high above fragrant gardens and grottos. Blue pools reflecting fair sights, stands and arbors of trees laden with golden fruit and crimson. Shady walks delightful, and higher still, pine woods heavy with scented shadows. The mountain top, ringed by noble minarets, is crowned above with a stepped pyramid of a singular grace, whose sides droop with hanging gardens, trailing trellises and lingering vines. Little singing waterfalls fall shining down its many airy balconies. Lily Moriah is kneeling, her arms embracing Azaziel's leg, her cheek against his knee. Her hair flows around her like long banners. She is not otherwise dressed. Nor, it seemed, is he. The black surcoat that served him as badge of rank Azaziel has thrown away. Aside from his own perfection, other clothes he desires none. His aura protects him against rain and cold and deadlier things which might harm him.
Idomenes is remembering a time as a child
when the angels dropped their auras and walked naked in the garden air of his father's fields and lawns. But the Typhonides and others had filled all the air with so many viral weapons specific to angels, nerve toxins and hallucinogens, that no angel dared shed his gleaming nimbus after.
As Idomenes climbs the wide flights of ivory stairs toward them, the sight of the two lovers burning and stinging in his eyes, an angry gesture twists his fingers.
An old, old program is opened in the memory of his assemblers. A military program, written by the sons of Typhon. Assemblers make black clouds around him as he strides in wrath up the slope, and draw carbon, hydrogen, and oxides out of the air with such force that he walks as if in a gale. When he passes the fruit arbors, an articulated exoskeleton embraces his form, with motors of shell and bone at all joints. When he passes the outer memory shrines, Heavy plates of black diamond armor have collected onto the moving frame. The plate could not have stopped bullets, perhaps, but angels fought with beams of laser flame. As he passes around the corner of the archive house, long firing tubes and launchers have collected on his back, and his magazines are filled with explosives. The wiring grown inside his armor is made of biological cable, like nerves, because his assemblers have no copper or gold to work with. He is going through final firing sequence system checks as he rounds the second corner and steps into the square where the fountain is. As he walks across the square toward the angel, his heavy motorized footsteps booming on the flagstones, a final touch of anger and pride make him grow ornaments of nacre and pearl and silvery horn along the hull of his black armor, and a tall, gay plume sprouts high from his helm. He must have looked splendid, for Lilla Mariah gazes at him with burning awe in her lovely eyes.
Idomeneus sees she is surrounded by the Dark Angel's sentry shield. The nimbus shimmers like gold in the air along her bare skin.
Azaziel speaks. Have you not heard that only three men have the right to go armed? The cruelty of the angels will destroy you if you raise weapons against your betters, little serf. The invigilators are not so unjust.
Idomeneus' voice, amplified, rings out from his armor, which is humming with power around him.
I am come to recover the girl you bewitch and abduct. My cause is right. I will not be condemned for it.
But he does not focus any aiming lasers toward the black shining figure, and his weapons still hover on standby.
Not so unjust, the Dark Angel mocks. Compared, I wonder, to what? Or do you call them fair because you dream you will be spared? Our race has a shameful history. The ship determined that that history must end. Has she not fulfilled every appearance of justice? There was no need to grant our appeal. Her mind is not mortal, not organic, works at a million times our speed, commits no errors, no oversights. How could she be wrong? Yet still she returned to Cannabis and Argo for review. The world there is governed by a mind even more deep and wise than hers. The world minds of every world gathered in Synod. The world minds called upon the star minds, each of whom guides many worlds. The star minds called upon energies we cannot imagine to link mind to mind across the stars and waken the will.
Idomeneus now speaks in a voice of rolling power.
The thoughts of the will are as infinitely wiser, deeper, more sure, more pure as the thoughts of the ship are above mortal organic thoughts. Perhaps you can doubt the wisdom of ships and worlds and stars, but surely no one can doubt the wisdom of the will. Dare you, dare even you who once served the will, doubt this? What can you set in your soul to guide yourself once you have rejected the guiding star of wisdom infinite? I set up my pride, says the Dark Angel, and his wings are spreading as he speaks. I will do no more shameful things, no matter at whose behest, but shall henceforth do only that in which I can take most pride. You are intoxicated, perhaps insane. All my assemblers to cleanse your system. See the light of truth, and restore my true love to me. The will being so wise, why are the innocent condemned? Those whose only crime is that they live on a world with evildoers? Guilt by dwelling nigh? And what of him whose only crime is that his disordered passions burn within his blood, his genes a howl of the wrath and meanness of all his apish fathers, to be inclined to sin while lingering sinless? We call this innocence.
Idomeneus is not sure how to answer. Then he says grimly, Those who are worthy shall be spared.
Worthy? Whose rule is so true to measure it? Whose weights are so sound that they may weigh the souls of men? The ship cares little for the lives of little men. Why else sleeps your father's city here deserted still?
Idomeneus, perhaps, feels a moment of coldness.
He cannot answer these questions. Instead, he points his finger at the angel,
aiming lasers follow his finger and lock on. The heavy weapons on his back rear up on their jointed arms, hissing like snakes, and point their deadly snouts where his finger points. "You have bewitched my love. Poison her with neurochemicals and hypno-narcotics. Release her!" Azaziel smiles down at the beautiful woman at his feet. "Tell him, my pet, my plaything, you willingly love me." Lilimariah says, "'Tis true. His child I carry, no others. He is strong where you are weak. My father has given him Assembler's program to sculpt an asteroid into a working starship. We will fly to the heavens without being anyone's domesticated slaves." And she laughs. Idomeni's soul is flayed by that laughter. In his armor he is shivering and sweating with rage. "She but speaks under your influence. Release her, or I fire." The angel regards the human weapons with amused contempt. He says, "What you describe is not an invigilated technology. I have done nothing to her. But I see by your gem that you are sincere. Here, I withdraw my shield from her. Perform your tests. Then see, then know, then confess to me how stupidly you have been wrong. This will shatter your pride, and then you may crawl off somewhere to die. Do you think the ship is so wise? By this act, by raising a weapon in anger, you have violated your parole. The invigilator law will drown you with the others." The golden glitter withdraws from Lilimariah's naked skin. She shivers in the air, and the fine, almost invisible hairs of her skin stand up, for it is growing now toward dusk, and long shadows fall across the courtyard and fountain. Idomeneus makes a gesture. A slim black diamond floats gently forward, touches her skin, pricks her. "Ow!" she complains. She moves to curl up to Azaziel, but his golden aura repels her. "I am applying a counteragent to restore your normal neurochemical balance," Idomeneus says. "Just a moment." At that instant, a large black diamond flies in from somewhere and shoots into Lilimariah's arm, leaving a small wound. She screams in pain and terror, and a host of her own assemblers pour upwards out of ornaments in her hair into a defensive formation. Azaziel shouts in astounded anger, such a shout as angels cry, and throws his aura like a cloak around Lilimariah's shoulders. He spreads his wings to take flight. Idomeneus cries out in panic and rage and hate to see his lover about to be carried away forever, and he lunges forward, fingers curled. He will tell himself later that his gun barrage went off by mere mischance, that his hand was perhaps jarred by the sudden motion into the trigger gesture. So he will tell himself. With a roar like 100 thunders, flares light up on his shoulder racks, rockets streak out, trailing streams of boiling smoke. His major cannons, left and right, vomit explosive flame, jarring mind and sense and hearing. Minor cannons rattle with jackhammer concussions, a numbing blur of noise. Azaziel's aura flares to the greatest of its great power, and cloaks the angel in an eye-searing flame. His compensating field is insufficient. The shockwave of the attack throws him backwards through the wall of the archives. The beautiful building is blackened and smashed with fire as Idomeneus' micro-rockets and beam-guided missiles jump in through the holes. Idomeneus is beginning to realize the enormity of his error when Azaziel, shaped now like a pillar of fire, emerges from the archive, reducing roof and walls to tumbling ash as the swirling column unfolds to its full height. Like a tornado, Azaziel glides forward, and an arm of lightning dips toward Idomeneus. Lesser assemblers and floating globes, like a black snowstorm, try to swirl into the path of the beam. Idomeneus has harness jets, and prosthetic leg motors assist his panicked leap to the side. The beam of lightning tears off huge chunks of Idomeneus' armor and tosses him headlong in mid-leap, but the blow is glancing, and the diamond panels refract the beam just enough to send lances of scattered fire into the observatory. The beautiful building is impaled with roaring flame.
Idomeneus tries to cry out words of apology, perhaps, or peace, but the roar of fire and explosion is all around him. He jumps and fires, smashing through more walls and roofs as he does so. Through the smoke and terror, he can see the twin slender beams of Azazel's eyesight slicing through walls and smoke clouds, hunting him. Azazel's fiery column sweeps through the area, devastating all. The fountains explode in a tangled convulsion of steam. Azazel's shields falter, perhaps grounded or cooled by the water.
Idomeneus forgets all thoughts of peace when he sees the dark angel rising into the air, haloed in fire, stealing Lily Maria away. He glimpses her teary face. Her mouth and eyes are wide. He leaps, kicked aloft by coughing jets, and attempts to grapple the angel. A force of fire explodes in his faceplate as his arms close around the burning pillar of Azazel. His diamond armor is blasted awry, molten lumps flying backward. But his arms manage to grab something. Whatever is in his grasp slides under his whining gauntlet motors and crackles with electric tension, formless, like forcing two opposite magnets together. Azazel's calm, dispassionate face is staring into the faceplate of Idomeneus, a sight of eerie terror. Inches before him, Idomeneus sees the energy fields swirling in front of the dark angel's eyes, growing bright, gathering power. The dark angel squints. Before Azazel's gaze can smite him, an unexpected force thrusts the two combatants apart and flings them both to the ground. Here is Uriel, prince of angels and foremost of their kind, blazing, and he stands in midair now between them. From his upraised palms comes a pulse. The combatants are held apart. Here also is stern Deucalion. The old man wears a green thinking robe. He is surrounded by glittering assemblers, more numerous and better made than his sons. In his brow he also carries a ruby. A look of stern sorrow is graven on his features. Deucalion points with his glove,
and a command signal overrides Idomeneus' assemblers.
The black diamonds attempting to repair Idomeneus' armor now reverse their actions.
The armor sways and fell to pieces around Idomeneus,
disintegrating in huge sliding lumps and glittering dusty slithers. Azazel, meanwhile, smothers his aura. Gold light, not flame, surrounds him.
Idomeneus is in pain from a dozen burns, lacerations, sprains, pains, even worse.
He fears bones are broken. He cannot rise to his feet. And the assemblers, which normally would have been swarming to heal him, are fallen to the blackened ground, motionless. Azazel, on the other hand, is not a strand of his black hair misplaced. He flexes his wings around him and crosses his arms on his chest. He says nothing. Lily Maria, behind him, is unharmed, although her face is full of emotion.
Idomeneus listens to his ears ringing in the sudden silence.
All around them are the cratered remains of once great buildings, the works of his father's architecture, smoldering, blasted, ruined, destroyed. Deucalion says,
"Abase yourself before the high exemplar Uriel, and beg forgiveness, and you may perhaps be spared."
The word exemplar is an old term for the invigilators from the days when they were meant to serve as examples to mankind rather than as punishers.
"The asteroids of ice begin already to fall. You have had a blameless life, but if you err, even on the last day, even at the last hour, you will not be saved."
Idomeneus,
unable to rise, cranes his head and looks toward Uriel. The archangel's aura is so bright that it crackled with sparks and little arcs of fire.
"I apologize for harm I've done. I meant no disrespect.
but the words come grudgingly forth.
Idomeneus does not believe in his heart that he had done anything wrong.
Azazel says with disdain, "Roll over, fetch, play dead." The light from Uriel's eyes
touches Idomeneus' ruby.
He sees his thoughts. Uriel says nothing. Lily Maria, half hidden behind Azazel's back, her hand on the dark angel's shoulders, says in a sad, haunted voice, "Do not be slain for my sake."
"I'm sorry, Idomeneus."
"I am under no influence now, nor any thoughts of mine bewitched. And yet I say I must go with Azazel." "Is it him you love?"
Idomeneus knows pain beyond his wounds.
His voice is a hoarse rasp. She hesitates. Then, "Yes, as much as my heart can do." Her voice is faint. Then she says, "Now, make peace with your father, and kiss his hands, and go your way with the angels of death who condemn and slay mankind." The hatred in her voice is clear. Deucalion says to Uriel, "Tell me my son can be saved. I have no one else." Uriel speaks. His voice is quiet and gold. "His trust is gone. When humans do not trust, they fear. When they fear, they kill."
Idomeneus lifts himself partway on his hands, rearing up.
Blood breaks through his burns. He winces. He shouts out, "How can I believe in the justice of the will if the reasons of the angels are not just?" Deucalion says, "Their justice is beyond our understanding. But is there any race so deserving of death as mankind? Can you think of an act of evil, no matter how heinous, which we have not done? Not done in secret, but while crowds cheered?"
Idomeneus shouts again.
"Is the innocent child who grows in Lily Maria's womb so guilty that he is deserving of death?" Uriel speaks again. "He is condemned, because no one can guarantee that when he grows, neither he nor any of his progeny will never work murder or theft or deception on the innocent hosts who live among the will. Quite the opposite. When humans gather, crime is certain."
Idomeneus is angry.
"My life has been in service to this? Is this what you call justice? None can survive this rule. None can live so." Uriel says in a voice of haunting beauty, "There are races that do not enslave, do not slay, do not war. There are races which do not lie or falsify. You think them weak, but they are among the strongest and finest denizens of the will. They waste no treasure, nor time, nor grief, nor lives, nor blood, to maintain the ungainly apparatus of suspicion and bloodshed you call government. The princes and policemen and hangmen, without which you humans dare not risk to live with each other. Weak? So would savages, whose every cottage was a fortress and every door a barricade, think your race. And yet, among the stars, there are crystalline civilizations so complex, so swift, and so trusting that a single lie could ruin them. Do you think the will is weak, then? Observe the strength granted those who serve it." And at his word, an earthquake shakes the mountain.
Idomeneus looks to the railing.
He feels a swaying, weightless pitching. Beyond the rail, he sees the ground departing slowly away. There came a moment of mist. Then they are high, no longer at twilight, but back in the day. Beyond the railing is cloud. Deucalion says, "We are risen. My son is still with us. Does this mean he can be saved?" He points with his gloves,
and many assemblers swarm over Idomeneus, tending to his wounds.
Uriel is silent, staring grimly at Idomenes. Deucalion says,
"Son, you know it is wise to agree with the exemplar. Think of what you will gain if you quell the rebellion in your heart."
Idomenes says,
"Father, I mean not to grieve you, but a man cannot make himself believe a lie just because it profits him. Men do not hold to the truth because it is useful, or comely, or safe. Men hold to the truth because it is true. And I was not told the truth."
Azazel mutters, proudly said, "Would that my docile brother angels had such hearts of fire as this lowly mortal."
Uriel says,
"Truth, we spoke not to you, foreknowing you would say such words, too arrogant to be unsaid. Our justice grounded on stern practicality." Lily Maria, her voice thick with hatred, her eyes smoking, now spoke,
"Death angel, what you call justice is nothing but fear, fear of mankind. And because you came from fear to doom us, we have no fate but to make ourselves as fearsome as we can do. Fools, fools, all fools! We had no care for your world minds and your will and your grave deliberations. Do you think murder is not murder because it is done by judges or governments or gods? No, we prayed for those appeals. And every delay, 60 long years of delay, we Typhonides employed to make ourselves as ready for war as we could do. What care we if you drown the world? Already my father and his people have altered themselves, painful mutations and ugly, and sink down to dwell in the deepest chasms of the ocean bed, where sunlight never can reach. There they will breed a race of monstrosities, a race of magicians, in sunless domes and fortresses far beneath the waves. From there they will wage eternal war, fueled by restless hate unending. You think to drown the world in water? They shall drown the world in blood. You cannot blockade our ascent forever. One day the stars shall be ours. Then the stars themselves shall drip blood."
Uriel turns to Idomenes and says gravely, "Do you see what it is we must act to prevent? This woman is unworthy of your regard." Idomenes answers bravely,
"And yet she should not die. Acknowledge your wisdom. The one we chose to live is the one worthy. Only Deucalion. We spare his wife for his sake."
Now Uriel turns to Azazel.
"But as for you, you have violated our laws. Capitulate to our judgment, meekly surrender, or I bring terrible arms to bear."
Azazel laughs a laugh of scorn.
"What do I care for your frowning brow and threatening word? I know your arms, and I know I am safe. But even if I were not, I would not cower to you. I will do only what pride bids me do. So I have sworn, and will do no shameful thing or anything prompted only by fear." "Capitulate? How?" the proud angel continued. "Your own law says you will kill to protect anyone who might one day perhaps, threaten the civilization you so adore. Should I not have as much love as that for this my child, whom, if I capitulate, you kill? No, tyrant, my ears are closed to that base cruelty you call justice. Such reasoning offends reason, and would make killers of us all. For each man perhaps might threaten all others. Your rule is the rule of endless war. I say no more to you. You are unworthy even of contempt. I turn me now from the creature I most despise to the one I most love. Hear my will. Pride likewise will not allow me to cower beneath the bellies of dolphins, to live in the sunless mud, in the pits beneath your seas. The stars are mine. I claim them my birthright. We will go aloft, you and I, and I can instruct you in the secrets of angels. Come, will you go with me? You will never see friends or father or family again if you go." She speaks in a voice of passion. "You are my lord and master. Wherever you go, I find joy without equal. Carry me up to your dark, wide abyss." Azaziel gathers her in his arms and steps upwards into the air. Uriel starts to raise his hand, red-hot lightnings forming in his palm. But Idomenes, staggering, steps toward the couple and into his line of fire. Uriel withholds a stroke.
"Lilimariah!"
Idomenes cries in a ragged voice.
"Wait, wait, I still love you. Come back!"
And Lilimariah, looking back over the dark angel's shoulder, has tears in her eyes. But she says only, "There are duties stronger than love."
Idomenes makes a choking cry
and clutches the railing, looking up. It looks like a tear falling down, shaken from Lilimariah as she turns her face away. Something of sorrow appears for a moment in Uriel's face. He closes his fingers on his white fire, extinguishing it without casting. The teardrop glitters as it falls. Unseen at the last moment,
it swerves in midair into Idomenes' palm.
He closes his fingers to catch it. Azaziel and Lilimariah, shining in gold, dwindle to a bright point high above and are gone.
Idomenes feels a sting in his palm.
Behind him, he hears Deucalion say softly to Uriel,
"Zazia was your firstborn son. I grieve for you, old friend. Perhaps he was enchanted."
The assembler in Idomenes' palm manipulates his nervous system and creates the illusion of a voice in his ear.
"Now I break my oath, as you broke yours for me. My love, my dearest love, my sweet and only true love. I am compelled to go with Azaziel by my father's will. The love potion you found in me, I injected willingly, without which Azaziel could not have been deceived. He lowered his aura to embrace me many nights, and the mind-altering effects of this concocted love spread to him. His artificial race, born from humans by the arts of the ship to police and rule us, is not so different at the deep neural structures from the spurned parental stock. All that has been done to save my race from extinction. I have been injected with your mother's gift to replenish mankind. It was my father who directed remotely that library, which you gave him, into me. It was necessary to seduce a death angel to our cause, for we had no other way to establish a foothold on other planets, to spread far enough that no single disaster could ever threaten us again. All else has been a feint. The tumults in the city were meant to occupy the angels and thus prevent Azaziel's capture. The citadels which Father has established at the bottom of the sea, the races who shall be for centuries devoted to hatred and bitter war, are likewise merely a feint that I and my child, and all my children to come, might be overlooked. Evil I have done you, great evil. I beg your forgiveness, knowing it might never be granted. I pray you will remember me with a love that equals my own. My fate is in your hands. The fate of all my generations, children and grandchildren, that should have been yours. To tell the death angels destroys all." Uriel is saying to Deucalion, "Azaziel has internal energies shielding his nervous system, so that he should go without his aura among your poisoned air and fear no nanotechnology. I wish I could say he was deceived or enchanted or ill. It is not so. He spoke the truth. It was his pride which led him, eyes open, to his fall."
Idomenes is almost blinded with tremors of hate that run through him.
He thinks, "So, Azaziel is the hero after all. Not deceived nor enchanted, he sacrifices honor and family and home to oppose a hideous injustice, and the love of a fair maiden as in a fable. He wins, Uriel says. There has been too much tragedy here. We will spare your son's life for your sake, Deucalion, because your love and strength are greater when he is near. The knowledge of our mercy may yet soothe the wrathful and proud imaginings that now so torment him. Perhaps even he can find a place in the service of the will. Turn, Idomenes. Let me see your face, that I might know your thought and say if you are worthy of the salvation offered you.
Idomenes does not turn, for he knows his thoughts will reveal too much.
Below, far down, he sees the sea. Dolphins dance in the waves, the new masters of the world.
What is your decision, Idomenes?
His father's voice trembles. I love you dearly, father, he says without turning his head. But there are duties stronger than love. Injustice must be fought, even the injustice angels do.
Idomenes triggers his assemblers to begin reconstructing his armor as he throws himself over the railing.
There is a long fall before he will strike the sea. He hopes there will be time for the assemblers to create what he needs to allow him to survive the impact. The fall is a long one. Perhaps it is enough.